Are you a leader? You may say, well, how would I know? Well, let me ask you two questions. Number one, are you going somewhere? Number two, are you taking anyone with you? Let me give you a simple definition of a leader. A leader is someone who has a compass in his mind and a magnet in his heart. Someone who is going someplace and has the ability to gather people to go with them. You say, well, you know, I never really thought about myself as a leader. I think of myself more as just normal, whatever that is. Let me suggest to you that I truly believe that God created every single person to lead. Now, that leadership may take place on many different levels. It may be leadership within a family, challenging a family to move forward in a positive direction and taking the family along. That leadership may be in a business. That leadership may be in a ministry. That leadership may be among peers. But it's going somewhere and taking people with you. The problem with leadership is it's just plain hard. It's tough. And I believe that most people don't lead not because leadership is something that they're not capable of doing, but something that they're not willing to pay the price to do. For you see, in any leadership endeavor, you will always encounter two problems. One of the problems is a problem from without. That is, anytime you're trying to go in a direction, you will always face resistance. There will be problems to overcome. There'll be tensions. There'll be difficulties that you have to overcome. And the second thing you'll always find in leadership is the ranks, the people that you're taking with you, they will always complain. Especially when things don't go well. For you see, once someone chooses to follow you, you're responsible. And if life is tough, it's your problem. And I believe that the reason why many men will not assume a positive, responsible leadership in the home is because it's hard. Why many people, men and women alike, will not take leadership in the church because it's tough. Why in business, many people, if it weren't for the big incomes, would never manage. And many who are not really leading. They're just filling that place on the organizational chart called manager because leadership is hard. How do I, as an individual called by God to go someplace and take people with us, how do we overcome these leadership challenges? Well, we can look at a model of someone who had a tough time leading and how they responded by turning to the book of Exodus and looking at Exodus chapter 17. Exodus chapter 17, where we find Moses in the midst of a leadership challenge or a crisis. Yesterday, I was doing a little Christmas shopping. Actually, I wasn't doing a little Christmas shopping. I was kind of traveling around. You know, most men are only good at Christmas shopping within the 48-hour window. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the 48-hour window starts 48 hours before Christmas morning. It's somewhat 48 hours around the Christmas time. You know, sometimes it can float over and back. That's when men are really good shoppers, typically. Well, I was just going along with my wife and three of our children, and we ended up at Toys R Us, and my wife sent myself and the children out. We were playing too much and you know, kind of getting in the way of shopping, so she ran us out, and she was probably going to purchase something for herself and didn't want us to see it, and so we made our way over to the family bookstore. We walked into the family bookstore, and every single person, I think, from Hill Country Bible Church was in the family bookstore. And you know why? The reason why everybody was in there is because our junior high ministry offered free childcare yesterday And let me tell you, I came by here, it wasn't just childcare. These kids were having a whopping good time. Playing and singing and doing crafts and sporting activities. Our junior high ministry provided free childcare for people so that they could go Christmas shopping. Why did they do that? Because they want to tell you how much they love you. And they want junior high kids to learn what it means to give, to serve. I was driving through the parking lot and I stopped out there and I saw Phil Dady out there working with some kids. I saw Ron Hunt out there working. I thought to myself, these people are great people. I mean, these people that would give up a Saturday and all the planning. Hill Country Bible Church is the greatest church on the face of the earth. We've got great people in our church. Well, let me get back to my story. I'm in the family bookstore and I run into a couple. And we started a dialogue, and this couple's involved in a major ministry of our church. And the wife started saying, you know, do you ever just feel like nothing is going right? And she was referring to the ministry that they were involved in. She said, do you ever feel like, man, it would be better just to cancel everything and start over again? It just seems like there are so many problems. And, you know, I looked at her and I could feel what she felt, because anytime you find yourself in leadership, you're going to find lots and lots of problems. Leadership is not an easy thing to do. Well, we stood there and talked for about 30 minutes while Cindy sat out in the car waiting. She didn't know where we were. Hey, don't ever leave your husband or kick him out of Toys R Us. There's a lot of good stuff in there. It's a little passive-aggressive there. Moses faced a challenge. Let's look at the challenge. Actually, he faced two challenges. The first one we see, in the first seven verses, it says, "From the whole Israelite community set out from the desert of Sin, traveling from place to place as the Lord had commanded. They camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink, so they quarreled with Moses and said, 'Give us water to drink.'" Now, this is the second time, you remember. They came through the Red Sea. They landed at Marah. When they got to Marah, the water was bitter, and the people grumbled against Moses, said, "How could you let this happen to us?" God healed the water. They had water to drink, and right over the sand dunes, they came to Elim. At Elim, there were 12 springs of water, one for every one of the tribes, so God could say, "Listen, guys, I'll get you what you need." Then the people complained about no food. Even though they had plenty of livestock, they complained, so God sent the manna to feed them. So God's taken care of them. Now they come to Rephidim, which is close to Sinai, the place where they're going to end up, where they're going to receive the law, and they get there and there's no water. And so they grumble against Moses. Now the word they quarrel against Moses. The word quarrel in verse 2 is a word that means to bring a formal complaint or a formal charge against another person. It's a word that's used in legal settings of a complainant swearing out a complaint. They're looking at Moses and they're saying, "Moses, we have a grievance against you. It's at the level of a lawsuit. And we are arguing with you." Notice what they're saying. In verse 3 it says, verse 2 it says, "They quarreled with Moses and said, 'Give us water to drink.' Moses replied, 'Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put the Lord to the test?' But the people were thirsty for water there, and they grumbled against Moses, and they said, 'Why did you bring us out of Egypt to make us and our children and livestock die of thirst?'" Now here we come to what I believe is the first challenge that leaders face. The challenge comes from within, from the people that you are following. When things go wrong, oftentimes people will question the motives or the sincerity of the leader. Notice what they're saying to Moses. They're saying, "How could you bring us and our little children and even our animals out here to kill us, to make us die of thirst?" The implication is, Moses, you are as sinister as they come. You plotted this thing all along. You planned it. You brought us out here to die of thirst. Now, we know from the events that have happened, this is completely irrational. Moses couldn't have made all this happen. But when the thirst is present, when the problem is present, oftentimes people will criticize the very motives of the leaders. And let me tell you, I believe of all the leadership challenges, this may be the hardest one. When a parent looks at the child in the eye and says, well, let me tell you that we're going to do this, and this is for your own good, and the child says, well, you don't love me, or you're just doing this because this is what you like to do. You don't care about me. Boy, you know, that stings. That hurts. When a small group leader challenges the group to grow spiritually, and people in the group begin to question their motives, that is hard. When as a manager, you know that the best thing for your employees is to take a particular direction, and you start to lead and things get tough and everybody looks at you and says, you're just in this for yourself. You don't care about us. Those things hurt. They are difficult. A number of years ago, Sonny Jurgensen was the quarterback of the Washington Redskins professional football team, and a reporter was talking to him because they were in the midst of a major slump. And the reporter asked him if it was getting to him that he was receiving all the criticism as the quarterback, everybody blaming him for the slump that they were in. And he smiled with his big toothless grin and he replied, nah, not me. I've been in this game a long time to know that every week the quarterback is either in the penthouse or the outhouse. He said, the penthouse is more fun, but a leader isn't in it nearly as much as he's in the outhouse. And that's very true. You will never be able to plan and execute a direction that is so smooth that you won't encounter problems. And when you encounter problems, you can anticipate that people will complain. And oftentimes when they complain, they will attack your motives as the leader and criticize you. Now, what Moses could have done at this point in time is he could have said, well, I'm leaving. I mean, I don't need this. Why would I bother? And all the hassle, all the late nights, all the weekends, all the extra work I've done for these people, gone out on a limb, sacrificed my nice, comfortable living over in Midian to come out here and lead these people? I don't need this. He could have taken it personally, but that's not what he does. Notice what he does in verse 4. Then Moses cried out to the Lord, what am I to do with these people? They are almost ready to stone me. This is serious. And the Lord answered Moses, walk on ahead of the people, take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Now, what he tells Moses to do is very informative. When people question your motives, what do? The first thing he tells Moses is, stay out in front. Go before the people. Don't retreat to your tent. Don't go hide in the background. You are the leader. Keep leading. One of the greatest tendencies when someone begins to criticize you as a leader is to stop leading. And then everything falls apart. Whenever you're in that position, the first thing is to keep leading. That's what God tells him to do. He says, get out in front of the people. Go out in front of the people. And then he says, take with you some of the elders of Israel. Why is he taking the elders of Israel? They're going to be the witnesses that God is going to use this man in his leadership. And I believe that that's the second major critical mistake that many people feel. When they begin to be criticized as a leader, rather than rallying the troops, the leaders together, pulling together a group of people to work through this, to look for God's direction, to see it through, oftentimes leaders will isolate themselves, and sometimes it's because they feel hurt by the people in leadership. How come you didn't defend me? How come you didn't stand with me? And so they isolate themselves. He says, no, I want you to take these people with you. Take them with you to be the witnesses. Third, and most importantly, he says, to take the staff in your hand with which you struck the Nile. Take the staff, the rod of God. When you go, you take the staff that you stretched over the Red Sea and part of the sea. You take the staff that you have used to show Pharaoh the plagues. You take the staff which represents God's power. You go with my power. And finally, he says, number 4, and go. Don't sit around. Don't cry. Don't pout. Don't spend time thinking through all of the wonderful things that you've done for these people and how great they ought to appreciate you and how much they ought to love you and all that they've done for you. You get up and get it done. Keep moving forward. And so Moses does that. Notice what God says he's going to do. In verse 6, he says, I will stand there before you by the rock at Horeb,
strike the rock, and water will come out of it for the people to drink. So Moses did this in the sight of the elders of Israel. An incredible miracle. He takes the rock, he hits the staff, the rock breaks open, and water begins to pour out, and all the people have water to drink. Now this is a symbol of Jesus Christ. In 1 Corinthians chapter 4, it says that when the people of Israel were traveling through the wilderness, they drank from the rock. And then Paul says, which was Christ Jesus. In other words, Jesus Christ is the water of life. And when Jesus Christ was struck on the cross, when he was pinned to the cross, what flowed from him was a river of life that anyone who drinks of it can experience the life-changing reality of Jesus Christ himself. Now, rather than celebrating this as a great victory, this is a sad day scenario. And notice what he says in verse 7. And he, that is Moses, called the place Massah and Meribah because the Israelites quarreled and because they tested the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? He doesn't give this a positive name. The word Massah means to test. The word Meribah is the Hebrew word for quarrel. He named the place of quarreling and the place of testing, because they tested God and they quarreled with Moses. In other words, in the midst of this incredible miracle, water from the rock, and, you know, I can think of a whole bunch of great names that he could have called it, you know. The day God gave the water, water from the rock, you know, rock water. He could have named the thing all kinds of names, but he gives it these negative names. Why? Because the sad day scenario is a day when the people of God complain against their leaders because they have lost faith. Whenever there's an internal problem, whenever the source comes from the people you're leading, that's a bad day. And even though God may do a miracle, it's still a bad day. He says the people actually ask the question, is God with us or not? Have you ever asked that question before? You know, one of the difficulties of humanity, and I've seen it in my own personal life, and I've seen it in lives all around the place. When everything is going well, we have a tendency of saying, boy, God's here, isn't he? Well, you can really see God here. I mean, look at all the people. Look at all the good things that are happening. Look at everything that's happening. Boy, God is really present. He must be with us. And you know what? When things are going bad, what do we have a tendency to say? Boy, God's deserted us. Where is God? You know, when the finances are a crisis at home, somebody loses a job, somebody goes through a health crisis, like, well, God can't be in this. If it's bad, God must have disappeared. Where is God? And that's the time when people have a tendency to criticize their leaders. When things are going bad, God's deserted, there's no one else to blame, so it must be the leader's fault. And you'll feel that. You'll experience that. That's a bad day. And even though God can come in and do a miracle, that still goes down in history as a bad day. Now, there are good days. I want to show you a good day. Look at verse 8. It says, the Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites at Rephidim. Now, the Amalekites are a nomadic group. They don't come on a frontal assault. Deuteronomy chapter 25 tells us that what they were doing was they were picking off the people on the edges of the camp. We showed you the pictures of this territory. It's a big territory. There's a lot of hills and valleys and kind of mountainous areas. And when you think about camping out all of these people would be scattered over a pretty big area. And what the Amalekites would do is they would send raiding parties in, and they would come through one corner of the camp, and they would kill the people, and they would steal their stuff, and then they would ride on out of there. Bad problem. Now the problem is a problem of direction. We're trying to get where we're going, and there's an enemy who's attacking us. So what does Moses do? Verse 9, he comes up with a plan. Moses said to Joshua, choose some of our men and go out and fight the Amalekites. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. So Joshua fought the Amalekites as Moses had ordered, and Moses and Aaron and Hur went up to the top of the hill. As long as Moses held up his hands, the Israelites were winning. But whenever he lowered his hands, the Amalekites were winning. Whoa, what a strange scene. His team, his plan, pick our best guys, send them out there to fight. They're out there fighting. He's standing up on the hill, overlooking the battlefield, watching it. And the Amalekites and the Israelites are going back and forth, and he takes the staff, the rod of God, he raises it above his head, and as long as it stays above his head, his guys are winning the battle. But whenever he gets tired and he starts to lower his arms, people start to lose. Like, people are dying. Friends of his are getting killed. They're losing the battle. Now, why the symbol? What God is demonstrating here is that only by the power of God can they win the fight. They didn't become better warriors when the staff was up and become lazy when the staff was down. God is demonstrating that he is the one who fights the battle. So regardless of how good the plan is, it's not enough without God's presence blessing it and winning. Now here comes one of the most significant principles of leadership that you'll ever know from this passage. Now follow very carefully because this is incredibly important. What happens, verse 17? When Moses' hands grew tired, they took a stone and they put it under him, and he sat on it. Aaron and Hur held his hands up, one on one side, one on the other side, so that his hands remained steady. How long? Until sunset. So Joshua overcame the Amalekite army with the sword. Now, the staff represents the power of God. And what this passage is communicating to us is the leaders often can't maintain a clear grasp on the power of God, keeping that forefront in their mind and in the minds of the people around unless they have help. Unless there are people standing beside them helping them. In other words, leadership is not a singular proposition. That's why God said that the church should be led by elders, a plural group, more than one individual. And when the leader starts to lose his grip, when the leader fatigues, when the leader can't keep his eyes focused on God, can't keep God before the people, he needs someone to stand beside him. And they literally sat him down on a rock, and Aaron stood on one side, and Hur stood on the other side, and they held his hands up for him to give him the support that he needed. Now let me ask you, who would know, who in your life would know if you started to lose your grip on God's power? Who in your life would be aware? If you're a father who's trying to give spiritual leadership to the family and you're slipping, you're getting tired, fatiguing, and you're losing it, who would know that? Who would be there by your side to hold your hands above your head to keep you focused? Who would be that person? Who would be there? See, the reality is that most people don't have anybody. They don't really have an Aaron or Hur. They don't have a close enough friend who knows them intimately enough and knows the circumstances of their life that could say, hey man, you're losing it. You're fatiguing. You're growing weary in well-doing, in your ministry, in your job, as a model, as an example, with your peer group. Who is there to help you keep your eyes focused on God? See, oftentimes we think, well, I can't lead because we tried and we failed. And we say, well, I just can't do that. And I would disagree with you. What you did was you tried and you failed because you failed by yourself. And there was a day when you held that banner up so proud and you held God's presence up and you said to everybody, this is the way we ought to go. And some people actually got excited about it and followed you. But then over time, it got hard and you got tired. And you began to get weary. And who was there to say, sit down here, let me help you. Let me stand beside you. Let me hold you and keep you strong in the midst of battle. When we face a challenge to our security, we can't rely on a good plan. We've got to trust God. And we will not trust God alone. We have to have help, other people who love us and stand beside us. And we have to seek those people out. Notice that this is a glad day scenario. In verse 14, then the Lord said to Moses, write this on a scroll as something to be remembered and make sure that Joshua hears it, because I will completely blot the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Now, just one footnote here.
The Amalekites, the people of Amalek, start this battle, and God says, I'm going to finish it. Don't ever start a war with God, because God sees it through to the very end. In 1 Samuel chapter 30, David eventually completely erases the Amalekites' existence from the face of the earth. We saw the same experience with the 10 plagues. God doesn't mess around. Don't you start a war with God. That's a huge mistake. And he says, they attacked my people, they're gone. Then Moses, verse 15, builds an altar. That means he began a worship service. Builds the altar, and he calls the altar, the Lord is my banner. He said, for hands were lifted up to the throne of the Lord. The Lord will be at war against the Amalekites from generation to generation. He names the altar, the Lord is my banner. The Lord is my rallying point. The Lord is the one I look to. He is my focus. When troops go out to battle, whether it's the flag or whether it's the banner, their colors goes before them to say, here, this is what we're fighting for. This is the focus. This is what it's all about. And Moses says, the Lord. That's what we need to focus on as leaders. Focus on the Lord. The greatest tightrope walker that ever lived was Carl Wallenda. And Carl Wallenda just amazed the world for a number of years as he walked tightropes high above the ground with no net. Considered just absolutely a phenomenon. And he was part of a bigger Wallenda family, and they traveled all over the world, amazing audiences. But something changed. Back in 1978, Carl Wallenda was on a 75-foot tightrope in San Juan, Puerto Rico. And as he was walking across that tightrope for the first time in his life, that man lost his balance and fell to his death. In interviews with his wife, after the event, his wife said that up until that particular tightrope walk, Carl never talked about falling, never thought about falling. It was never an issue to him. It never crossed his mind. But for some reason, when that event was scheduled, he began to worry. In fact, for 3 months prior, all he could talk about was falling. He even went to San Juan and personally oversaw the construction of the rope to make sure it was perfect because he was afraid of falling. And you know what? As long as he was not thinking about falling, as long as he was focused on walking the tightrope, he never fell. But the one time that he took his mind off of walking the tightrope and started worrying about falling, that's when he fell, and that's when he died. I believe the same principle holds true in the spiritual life. As a leader, as long as we're focused on God, looking to Him for the answers, looking to Him for the strength, looking to Him for the direction, we will be able to continue to lead. But at any point along the way, when we take our eyes off of God and start focusing on the problems, either the people that are unhappy with us or the obstacles in the direction we're going, anytime we do that, we will lose our capability of leading. And this world desperately needs not leaders. This world needs you as a leader. There are too many people who are saying, boy, we need to get some leaders. And missing the obvious. What we don't need to do is get more leaders. What we need to do is we need to become those leaders. We need to become men and women. We need to become teenagers who will step out and say, there's a direction worth going in, and I want to take you with me. And it may be 2, and it may be 4, or it may be 50, or 500. But I am called to lead. Let's bow our heads for prayer. Father in heaven, I pray that you would place that desire deeply in the hearts of the people in this room and in our congregation. There's a world that's wandering, groping in the darkness. It's too easy for us to find a passive approach. May you challenge us and stir us, change us to be men and women who are willing to go someplace and take people along. And Father, you promised to be with us. You've promised to give us your strength. You've promised to do incredible things if we'll but follow you. Give us the courage to do it. For we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.